You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is Wednesday, August 4th, 2021, and this, surprisingly enough, is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Normally the way I do these things, I have a topic picked out a few days beforehand, usually about 10 minutes before I start to record. I change my mind, and I have three or four other topics, so you never quite know what's going to happen. I have so many papers, some of them from years ago, laying around that I forgot about. Besides that fact, I'm working on seven or eight things at the same time, two books and God knows how many papers, and then refurbishing old ones that either I forgot about or I can add new information to whatever. And then who knows, new books come out of these. I don't know what's going on, but that's how this works. And today, going through the obligatory three or four topics, I came across one that I, as always, forgot about. And last summer, it became extremely important. With the riots after the George Floyd overdose death. And it's been around for a while. The issue's been around for a while. But it's taken on almost, you know, mass pop culture proportions, which is odd given the situation. This is the myth of King Leopold II in the Congo, or the Congo Free State. It said, and this is a very popular myth, you have, you know, Facebook was jammed with this. Statues of him were ripped down. Anyone even remotely defending him was driven from society. And I'm going to talk about something, a genre called atrocity porn, which is a phrase that I've coined. And it's a template. And when someone wants to consider a leader that they hate of all kinds of crimes, atrocities, genocide, there's a template that they follow. And there's very specific marks that every single one of these books or papers follows. And it's one of the ways you know it's phony. I've said 100 times that everything that the average educated American believes about the world is a lie. In one form or another. Now, that may be changing as people become more and more radicalized. But still, even those on our side can be just as dumb as those who are not. And information obviously isn't the issue. You're drowning in information. Information doesn't mean very much when you don't know how to situate it, when you don't know about context and method and fallacies, informal and otherwise. That's a matter of wisdom, and it takes a lot of time. Information doesn't mean a whole lot. Facts aren't facts. Facts only exist when they're situated in an understanding of the world. Otherwise, they're simply brute givens, no different than sense data. King Leopold II lived from 1835 to 1909, and he is said to be a genocidal maniac. Now, if you look him up and read some of these articles on him, it's pretty rare that you come across as the invective. Invective of people who've never heard of this guy before the other day, who read a newspaper article or two and are absolutely convinced that they know something about royal monarchical rule in the era. As always, with the atrocity porn genre, nothing makes any sense. Nothing's complicated. Nothing has context. Nothing has causes. But being the ruling monarch of Belgium, he sought an empire in Africa. And he ruled the Congo, which is Zaire, not the Republic of the Congo today. It's actually what Zaire is today. And the claim is that between 1885 and 1908, ruling that colony directly, somehow he murdered 10 million people in what's called this insatiable drive to profit from the rubber and ivory trade, among other things, in the area. The Congo Free State was something that he owned personally. And it wasn't until 1908 that the Belgian government took it over. The legislature took it over and ran it as an actual colony in the normal sense. Back in 1998, the founder of Mother Jones, most of you know that publication, which is a so-called democratic socialist leftist publication, Adam Hochschild, wrote a book called King Leopold's Ghost, A Story of Greed, Terror, and Heroism in Colonial Africa, published by Mariner. Now, the very fact that he's been involved in the anti-apartheid stuff means that, generally speaking, he's going to be cherry-picking his argument. It's not ad hominem to talk about the bias that these guys are going to bring to this. This is what they do all the time. And no one's really going to correct them on it. So Johnson's Law, as always, is very important here. So this book got all kinds of awards. It got a tremendous amount of attention, especially the last couple of years. In fact, it even gave birth to a very bad melodramatic movie in 2006 of the same name. It's inspired thousands of university courses, TV documentaries, museums, articles, and books, all repeating the same accusation. And what it comes down to is to justify hatred against whites, not just in Africa, but elsewhere. Disagreeing with this book can lead to expulsion, on-campus violence. On the external side, on the internal side, it goes hand in hand with the censorship to insulate these writers from any criticism. You can't put something on Facebook, for example, that attacks this book. It's almost a scriptural, considered a classic already, despite it coming out in 98. There hasn't been many refutations of this. Now the genocide myth has become pop culture. A kid named Ryan Falk in 2016 wrote a very good refutation of this, and I take this broadcast to some extent from it, simply called Mythologies About Leopold's Congo Free State. And little has been done on this, partially because of the lack of real knowledge. But you certainly don't need to be a specialist in the languages of Central Africa to understand how economics works, how royal rule works, how colonialism works, and how Africa works. His paper is one of the few. If you search for it in Google, anything critical of this book will not come up. You have to go to Web Crawler, or which I use, or Yandex, or DuckDuckGo, any of these. And it's a scholarly work, and it's a serious work. I've never heard of this guy before, but he approaches the topic from three points of view. But the conclusion, of course, is that there's no way, given a whole list of variables, that 10 million people could have been killed in a few years, between 1885 and 1908. The population of the Congo is actually less than that. The extent to which the king in Belgium can effectively rule a country of that size, and, of course, importantly, the number of agents that he had working for him in a very inhospitable part of the world. Now, there's more than that. Those are the three ways, and these are very simple ways, of refuting this myth. Now, of course, scholars in the area know that there weren't that many people living in that part of the world at the time. They could look it up, but they're not going to say anything about it. It's constant cognitive dissonance here. They know how colonial governments, especially in the jungle areas, work. There's a thin layer of military or police or paramilitary that they can rely on, and it's almost all local. They're all Africans. And given the nature of the fact that where it is and what kind of empire it is, how distant it is, that effective rule is almost impossible. Africans who were in treaty arrangements with the Belgians carried out most of the police duties. Now, if 10 million people were killed in a few years, according to him, that means half the population was murdered. By itself, numbers like this, very convenient, striking figures, are a part of this atrocity porn genre. A number like this, especially given the circumstances, should be treated with skepticism. This is a scholar's job, and of course it's not. Everyone reading this, if they could put their emotions and concern with being called names aside, realize that nothing about this story works out. It is that familial pattern of this elaborate sensational violence that typifies what atrocity porn is. It's the use of cheap emotionalism and sensationalism to invent this story of innocent victims and psychotic perpetrators. And you see this on every page of the Hutschild book. Atrocity porn is not history, it's not academia, it is a genre of literature. Whether something is true or not is a minor inconvenience. Now, the Congo Free State, which used to be called the independent state of the Congo, was vaguely where Zaire is today. It existed only from 1885 to 1908, same period of time that this was Leopold's name for it, his personal, privately owned and personal union. So it was a separate country, not even a colony. It was a separate country that he was the personal monarch. So technically, and legally actually at the time, he was a monarch of two countries. So technically this was not a colony. It only developed in 1908. He was able to get his hands on the region at the Berlin Conference on Africa, which was dividing up the continent. And he was able to establish his claim because his argument was he was involved in humanitarian and philanthropic work and wouldn't tax any trade in the area. The Berlin Conference was about developing the place economically. They knew it had tremendous resources, but it was very hard to get to, and you had a native workforce that had to be trained from the ground up. Creating the International Association of the Congo, which was the international body dealing with this Central Africa, he laid claim to almost all of the Congo Basin. The Berlin Conference closes in May of 1885, and he announced his name. And he, the International Association of the Congo now was finished. That was a previous name prior to his takeover. So this was a separate nation. This was not Belgian. Now, he never went there, and he was never quite sure what was going on there. He had advisors coming back and forth, telling him more or less what he wanted to hear. So the first issue, and this is, yeah, these are very simple arguments. And because they're so simple, you know, everyone who's promoting this, any actual scholar promoting this, is aware of how ridiculous it is. Now, the campus idiot and the campus airhead don't care. Emotion and the desire to fit in matters. But scholars do know that nothing makes sense about this story. Now, you know, part of Johnson's Law says that because these areas are very obscure, especially here, you don't even have official population figures. They could say whatever they want. The estimates that Falk and several others have come across is probably about under 10 million in 1900, probably a very high estimate. Some have put it at 3 million. Given this very densely packed jungle, you don't have a high population density. You're not going to have huge population centers there. I mean, all of Black Africa had about 110 million people at the time, and this was pretty much inhospitable, even by their standards. The Dutch paper by 1997, Goldvik Bateus, whatever the heck that is, can't pronounce the names, but it is the best analysis of the region's population. It's complicated, and it's all about estimating the amount of arable land used for agriculture based on ecosystem changes. Now, I'm not familiar, nor do I care what that is, but it does have very important population estimates and is considered pretty much the standard. It's also inconvenient for the argument of people who believe that this man was a maniac. It shows substantial population growth every year during this era. There's a whole bunch of other population estimates out there because you don't have official census, but you don't have you do have a consensus of a sort. So in 1890, there was about 3.3 million people living in that area. 10 years later, you had about 4.1 million. And by 1910, it was about 5 million. So automatically, the story of this genocidal maniac falls apart. Regardless of what the total numbers might be, no one denies that the population was growing at a rate a little bit more than 2% every year, while this, you know, genocidal maniac was slaughtering everyone. And Falk makes it clear here. He says, if someone was given an assignment to estimate the population of the Congo Free State in 1900 and didn't know about the 10 million killed by Leopold, and thus what the population had to have been for that time to be possible, they wouldn't come anywhere near 20 million, which, of course, is a standard view. They'd come to a mid-range estimate of 7 million, with the highest plausible being about 10.7 million, the absolute maximum at 15, a low estimate around 4 million, and an absolute minimum of 3.1. But the Dutch paper puts it at, 1900, 4 million, and growing consistently. Now, just as importantly, though, and this is a more technical element here, empires aren't countries, especially in a very foreign territory. A country like this, ruled largely by Africans in the employ of the King of Belgium, don't have effective control of most of the land. Certainly not in a heavily a jungle area. People speaking a language they didn't fully understand. They were reliant on the African tribes in the area. One of the marks of the amateur historians, I've said many times, is the assumption that countries were ruled and people thought 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, the same way they do now. Prior to the postmodern regime, it's very rare for any state to have any tight control over a population, especially a foreign one. Colonies, no matter where you go, colonies or this kind of personal union, were governed very loosely. And almost always, especially the French model, governed exclusively by local leaders that are loyal to the colonizing state. Now, the Belgian embassy in London, around the same time, said this. Finally, the cultivation of rubber was geographically restricted to the equatorial rainforest around the northern Congo basin, and to a less extent, to the Kasai region, totaling one-fifth of Congo's territory. The estimated 10 million deaths for the whole of Congo cannot be ascribed to the Belgians, simply because at the beginning of the colonization, they were not even present or active in the whole of the Congo. Of course, this is a much later discussion here. And it also states that the 10 million seems to be the standard so-called consensus figure. The point of this is, given the nature of the region, the economy, the state had very little effective control. So, you know, the amateur, you know, activist historian, liberals are known for this, are going to consider a rule of a Belgian ruler over a place like the Congo no different than the governor of Florida with the state of Florida. They don't see any difference there. Of course, it's even words like rule are problematic. Now, the other issue, of course, is what force would he have at his disposal? I've used this argument many times. If police forces, the German Gestapo, which never really had more than a few thousand unarmed members. But usually these forces, and this comes up again and again, were fairly small. At most, the Congo Free State had access to maybe a quarter of the population with any kind of direct status. The organization that was policing this area was the Force Publique, the FP, which was almost all African, and they were paid to police the area. And this is a group, by the way, accused of mass murder, and no one bothered to tell them that they were mostly locals. Now, Falk can't find the records of the size of this, but because of certain military obligations at the time, there are certain years that you have exact figures for. So in 1892, you had about 13,500. In 1908, at the end of all this, you had about 17,400. And after the state of Belgium took it over, 12,000 in 1914. Given the sheer size of the area, and given the millions of people who were living here, 13,500 people couldn't rule them, let alone slaughter them. Modern Zaire is an extremely large place. They're supposed to have slaughtered innocent, unarmed, and unorganized blacks for no reason. But this is the argument, and it's always for no reason. Anything complicated destroys this genre of thinking. Now, the FP was always much smaller than that. Those are paper deployable men. One of the things that Leopold did there, and one of the reasons he had personally for taking it over, was to destroy the slave trade. Slave trade was run out of Zanzibar, and it was a oligarchic, essentially republic, functioning really on the slave trade. A marauder named Tipu Tip, it was a nickname, who was a black slave raider, an oligarch himself, who had a claim to the eastern Congo, was pressing west and threatening the Belgian state. And because of this war, several others, exact figures of the FP are available. But they just refer to total manpower, not the total number that could be deployed. So you have an army of 10,000 men. That means at any given time, maybe 3,000 are ready for combat. So if you have 13,000 people, any given moment, at most, you may have 9,000. And given the warfare that this little state was involved in, for domestic policing, you had a few thousand at the most. So at its height, stretching credulity, you had no more than 10,000 men available for any kind of domestic policing. And that's pushing it. The tour of duty for these guys was roughly 7 years. Leopold ruled the Congo for 23, which means that he had 3.3 cycles of military deployment there. And it comes down to the fact that at any given moment, in this 23 years, you had about 50,000, 51,000 men in the FP during the entirety of this era. So being very generous, you have a rate of something like 200 men killed for every one member of the FP in order to get to 10 million, which of course is laughable under the circumstances. So at its height, you have usable police, paramilitary, what do you want to call them, at various levels of discipline and often very poor training, and mostly African. Not to mention the fact that they weren't in the assumption, of course, in all these this kind of nonsensical writing, that these are innocent blacks being killed. They're not armed. They're not organized. But, of course, that's not true. They were all armed. They were all organized. And they were experienced in battle. Warfare is very common in this area and typical of tribal societies. If they were able to unify, the FP would be routed. And they were defeated several times. But this conception isn't even mentioned. Not to mention the fact that the FP had local allies, usually used in foreign wars. So for those three areas, those three reasons, those three variables, it's absolutely absurd that you could possibly have 10 million dead. And the fact that Johnson's law, as you might imagine, means that he could do this. How many people could possibly put together a paper like this, showing in great detail how it is physically impossible? So Johnson's law says that since very few have the ability to refute an argument, certainly one, an argument that has become so famous, you're talking about an area that no one knows anything about. But the whole genocide literature, the atrocity porn, depends on this level of ignorance. Basic cognition, basic common sense is always ignored. And these are screeds in the true sense of the word. And the authors, as they're putting this stuff together, know that any disagreement in public with their work is going to lead to tremendous repercussions for the person daring to raise his voice. But the argument doesn't end there. Falk writes this. One issue historians face when condemning Leopold II is a lack of documentation. Even a BBC documentary blithely accused Leopold of destroying the relevant records. It's not a charge that's easy to respond to. How does one prove that no records were destroyed? But it shouldn't matter, because from 1904 to 1908, in response to the public outcry over the Congo, independent counsel created by Italy, Switzerland, and Belgium conducted an ongoing investigation and released periodical reports called the Official Bulletin of the Congo Free State. Of course, this council did not report extreme genocide going at the behest of Leopold's government. In fact, they reported that the abuses occurred almost exclusively and only when FP detachments were sent without a European commander, and that the presence of a European commander is what prevented atrocities and things like rape. Atrocities occur all the time. That would have been the case no matter who was ruling the area. But the atrocities that did occur were almost exclusively by African soldiers, if they didn't have a European commander. Therefore, reports of atrocities were leaking into Europe and certainly into Belgium. And of course, one thing he doesn't mention is that you had a smallpox epidemic as well as sleeping sickness that devastated this population. So even if the total deaths were high, it's impossible to discern what is responsible for what death. Now, you'll see in atrocity porn, you always have these lurid descriptions of how people are killed. You always have, babies being killed. You always have torture for no reason. You have rape everywhere. And Falk writes this. He says, in terms of mutilation, chopping off hands and feet, there's zero documentation that this was Leopold's policy, nor did the investigation find any evidence this was Leopold's policy. In fact, the investigation claimed that this was done by indigenous members of the FP, especially when a European officer was absent. In addition, chopping off limbs seemed to be a ridiculous policy, given that the biggest problem Leopold had was a labor shortage. It's also known that limb mutilation had occurred both before and after the Congo Free State, and without any reliable statistics, there's no way to know if it ever increased or decreased during the Congo Free State at all. In other words, you had atrocities throughout. In these tribal societies, it was constant. But one thing you'll find in the atrocity propaganda, and one of the marks of this whole genre, is that they'll describe these expensive and impractical forms of mutilation. North Korea is one of my favorite examples. North Korea, Johnson's Law, in its pure form, since you can't go there, So you have to, everything has to be secondhand. There's no investigation there for very good reason. I refuted some of the absurdities of the defectors who are paid in direct proportion to how lurid and important and significant their stories are. And those guys usually fight each other, calling each other liars. They do it all the time. One said that they saw prisoners tortured with molten lead being poured down their throat. You can imagine how difficult that would be. You'd have to have the equipment, incredibly expensive fuel source, and somehow get the molten lead down someone's throat. The whole thing is laughable. That actually comes up in a few of these atrocity stories. It's ridiculously impractical to do this. It never happened. The other one was a relative of Kim was strapped to an anti-aircraft battery, and it was shot off. Both of these are false. Both of these have been exposed as false since then, but they're still believed. And one of the marks of these kind of stories is that you're going to get all kinds of, they're racing to find the most lurid, disgusting forms of death. And the point is to get the attention of the reader, to get the reader now emotionally involved, and that seems to be about making them more suggestible. In none of these areas, colonial, slave, whatever, there's never any policy to harm anyone without cause. And given what this whole free state was, any policy wouldn't make any sense. The most that you got at the time, that you had some Belgians in the legislature blaming Leopold for allowing the black FP troops they were committing some atrocities there, not systematically, of course. They essentially viewed them as children in need of European supervision. But as Falk says, no one really has thought this through, because those pushing this myth have failed to realize that in the entire country at the time, at any given time, you had about 200 whites. And so they don't seem to understand that. You blame whites for this, it automatically means blacks are treated as pets. That they seem to agree. If there were more whites there, this wouldn't have happened. This is a purely African and African matter. And it would have happened no matter what uniform those working for the FP were wearing. This had absolutely nothing to do with Leopold, had nothing to do, in fact, it was completely against the self-interest of the Belgians at the time. But this atrocity propaganda has no real logical basis. And because of that, it relies on ignorance and emotion in order to function. I mentioned Tipu Tip before. It was an Islamic slave raider. Between 1892 and 1894, the Free State was at war with him. And usually it was over, slavery was banned under Leopold. And the attacks of Tip were about restoring slavery there. And the group in Zanzibar that sent him was planning on reviving slavery in the Congo. This was an oligarchic republic. So as this is going on, as I mentioned, the FP were struggling on the battlefield. In fact, they were defeated several times. Tip's forces overran an FP garrison in 1893. So they're struggling on the battlefield. They have a handful of men. Their equipment was, sparse, given the distances they had to cover, which means as far as domestic policing is concerned, they had a minimal presence. So the story that the History Channel puts out, that this book puts out, that's in every history class in every college in America, is absurd, and it can't stand up to basic common sense questioning. That's the case for most of these. And he writes this, and this is something that I've in some version or another, have said many times. He says, so if a dishonest or ignorant newspaper editor got some pictures or description of a battle in that war, he would have plenty of gory pictures and gruesome details, and he could then say, this is Leopold's Congo, who dishonestly seed the idea that it was normal Congo Free State policy. In addition, if, say, some men in the FP chopped off the hands of 20 people, well, 20 images could fill up an entire page. It would make it look like mutilation is happening all the time. Then he could say, this is Leopold's Congo. You could show them horrible hospitals, dirty, lacking supplies, without the context that this was actually a huge improvement over the folk medicine of the locals. But just images of the horrible hospital conditions by themselves leads them to say, this is Leopold's Congo. And emotion then takes over and fills in the blanks. This is why Johnson's Law is so extremely important. Public ignorance, especially in a place like this, means that there's simply no way to know whether any of this is true or not. But when he writes, when I just read there, that's precisely what the regime's media use to make enemies or depict enemies all over the world, not just historically, but in contemporary. From the British press in the Crimea, Japan, to the American media in World War II, in that respect, color revolution media today, the lurid stories of these horrible atrocities are day-to-day. These shocking stories, they're a way to gain readership as well as to promote a dubious and dangerous agenda. Fake pictures are a stock in trade of American media stories, especially in obscure places. Reading the Japanese works refuting the Nanking Massacre show bodies that could have been killed anywhere. There's a picture of a soldier chopping the head off the Chinese, except that the soldier's wearing a Chinese nationalist uniform. But no one's going to know that when they're leafing through this. So Johnson's Law says it's going to become an irresistible trend over time once the story begins to take root and germinate in the public mind. And it's typical when you're dealing with journalists without any specialized knowledge in the areas they cover or politics in general. Because the Congo had no form of official population statistics, Johnson's Law is going to say that because there's no record here, the press can invent whatever it wants. But it's the Congo. It's a place where people die all the time for the most horrible reasons, and they live in conditions that the Europeans at the time would consider almost unlivable. Now, the economy there was based really on two things. Slavery was not an issue, which was banned there, which was the reason that they were invaded by the Zanzibar movement. It was based on ivory and, to an even greater extent, rubber. They used corvée labor, meaning that workers had to not pay taxes in cash, but in kind. You didn't have a monetized economy. Without currency, they have to use labor. That's how most people pay taxes in the Third World in general. But Leopold's policy, we'll talk about this in a minute, that the tax should never be more than 40 hours a month. So he put limits on how this corvée would be distributed. You did not have a monetized economy. The only way to pay taxes would be to work. Now, the rubber boom really took off in the 1890s. In the 1890s, you had the development of things like the bicycle, and automobile, military technology, where rubber was in huge demand. So prices went through the roof, and this is why Leopold's group then shifted from ivory to rubber. Everything, you know, tires, tubing, insulation for telegraph, telephone cables, wiring, everything. So by the late 1890s, rubber had far surpassed ivory as the main economic purpose of the place. 1903 was the peak year. But it also meant that you had a rush for alternative suppliers. The British brought the rubber trees to Malaysia. The British, being to a great extent an enemy of Leopold at the time, then shifted their rubber purchases over there. Southeast Asia became the new, you know, huge plantations here, as well as Latin America. And once production increased, the prices started to dip. Competition then drove everyone to push labor harder. And this was the case in the Congo. This was the case everywhere. Not to mention that enforcing this system, as well as the external wars of the Free State, was reducing profit margins to razor thin levels. And the unsustainable harvesting methods was another matter. You didn't have a lot of high tech there at the time. It was very difficult to get equipment to that part of the world. So now Leopold's private company here is running up debts. And this was the context of this. So you had the corvée going up despite his wishes to the contrary. Speaking of, you know, the lurid, you know, limb chopping, which is almost every one of these stories has it. There's a few pictures of these Africans with missing limbs, and usually they're posed with Europeans, which doesn't make any sense. It's very hard to imagine that if these were, you know, the ones who did this, they wouldn't be taking pictures with them. Photos aren't part of the genocide plan. But all you have to do is show a picture of somebody missing an arm and say, this is what Leopold's forces did. And it's almost impossible to tell the difference. You could add a few personal accounts. You could add a couple of anecdotes, a few pictures. And given public ignorance and the fact that this is a purely racial matter in America, you can put an argument together that no one can refute. And maybe even explain away the fact that the population was going up through this period of time. So, who was Leopold II? There's a few excellent articles. There's a guy, some of you may know, the Mad Monarchist, who I've been reading for a long time. And it's one of the more recent, very good treatments of Leopold in general, not just in the African thing. In 2010, he wrote that Leopold II was obsessed with achieving international greatness for Belgium, and in 1876, convened an international conference on the exploration of Central Africa. So then he sent out Henry Morgan Stanley to put together treaties with the local chiefs and to build the Belgian presence there. Nothing could be done without the heads of tribal society. This became the Berlin Conference in 1885, and that gave the recognition, as I said, Leopold over the King Sovereign of the CFS, and a personal union in this case. So again, he became a private owner rather than a constitutional monarch. You're talking about a part of Africa in land area 80 times larger than his entire country. In 1890, it was clear, Leopold made it very clear, that he was organizing a military campaign to eradicate the Arab slave trade in Central Africa, which even, you know, up until fairly recently, was booming. Partially, again, because of the boom in rubber prices. So in July of 1890, the Brussels International Conference, a treaty was signed to officially fight militantly the African slave trade and slave smuggling. And the treaty formed the basis of his presence there. So that expedition was a huge success. And that was the beginning of the framework of his ability to develop the Congo, which then led to the rubber boom in that part of the world. But the atrocities came from overwork. But a few things need to be kept in mind. Again, you're not dealing with a lot of people. You're not dealing with high numbers. If even a tenth of these atrocities were true, no one would make any profit. Enforcement alone would eat up the profits that they had. The king was a hard man, was an unsavory character. Some people think that he was autistic. That's actually been thrown around quite a bit. But in no way did anything negative in that part of the world, which would happen anyway, given the fact it's the Congo, had anything to do with his wishes. Whatever happened there is about a system that was set up where, as he says, local officials were paid based on the amount of rubber they produced, which gave incentives for the unscrupulous. Now, chances are, given the price of rubber, that would have happened no matter who was ruling the place. That's a universal fact. You want to work your... this happened in Russian serfs and under Peter the Great. But this had nothing to do with Leopold. Leopold explicitly condemned this kind of thing. If development was the goal, then any atrocity at all doesn't make any sense. it would have destroyed prophets and disrupted society to such an extent that nothing would ever get done. Labor was a problem. Labor shortages were everywhere. And because of that, mutilating workers doesn't make any sense. It's like the slavery in the American South. That would be something along the lines of someone's tractor breaking down, and instead of fixing it, you destroy it. You beat it to death. That doesn't make any sense. Labor was at a premium there. So you did have scattered atrocities. And that, as I said, was leaked into Europe and to Leopold, who then sent a commission to the Congo to investigate, as I've already mentioned. And you had at least three countries involved. The commission met with native people, colonial officials, everybody who was there. And their report was balanced. There were some negative, some positive. And they do cite the advances made by these infrastructural investments. They made it very clear, compared to what was there before, roads, schools, hospitals, and local infrastructure were beyond anything that they were capable of doing themselves. You had Catholic missionaries who were doing incredibly heroic work there. But any abuse is cherry-picking and would have happened probably more so anyway. That was the norm there, and slavery was the norm there. So new regulations were put out, and this is one of the things that led in 1908 to the Free State to become an official colony under the legislature rather than under the monarch. But this was his idea. So the suffering that occurred, of course, is very real, but that's typical. That has nothing to do with whoever's ruling it. If anything, the standards existed were strictly from the king. The minute he found out there was a problem, if for no other reason, the money simply wasn't going to be made. The system did encourage exploitation. But given the rhetoric that's thrown against this man, and of course royalism, Catholicism, and everything else, it's laughable. He was not a heartless man. He was, this whole genre lives in believing you could look into his mind and see what his motives are. He wanted Belgium to become an imperial power. And he was extremely popular, especially at home. Huge national monument, he had a massive building. His economic policies were very successful. He was unpopular among his peers, though. And the main reason, of course, is that Belgium had reached now a status relative to its size far greater than even larger states. And whatever was going on in the Congo, the king was seen as a personal, in Europe, the personal cause of this. Domestically, Leopold passed the first free education system. That was in 1879, universal male suffrage in 1893. For the first time, labor unions were permitted. Not only was child labor banned, but workers' compensation was enacted. Because you have oligarchs who run the legislature, he wanted the royal referendum, which would mean that the king could go over the heads of the oligarchs and call a vote of the population in general on any issue. Now, the legislature rejected that, which is no big surprise. One of the things that drove the British crazy was during the Franco-Prussian War, he declared neutrality, saving his country from the ravages of that conflict, but he was more considered, especially in Britain, as pro-German. But the anti-monarchy, the anti-colonial press, especially in Britain, began painting him in the same way that they painted the Russian monarch, Nicholas I, during Crimea. But Leopold was not exactly known for caring about popularity. The armed neutrality was essential to his foreign policy. Military preparedness, but not trusting international agreements, especially if the British had anything to do with them. But so many of these stories, I've said this week, the Ivan the Terrible and a few others, the origin of these stories comes from suspect elements. Great Britain was the locus of anti-Belgian, anti-royal ideas at the time. Edmund Morel and Roger Casement, if Irishmen know who Roger Casement is, the British consul to the Congo at the time, Casement wrote the report that bears his name, and that report is mentioned by authors in the field all the time. But he was an enemy of everything royal and everything colonizing. George V granted him knighthood, and he refused it. And he joined the radical Republicans across the water. But on the other hand, he did, in Ireland, sought the alliance with Britain's greatest enemy, with the German Empire, and he planned rebellions in Ireland. In fact, Casement tried to convince Irish prisoners of war to form their own unit, to fight alongside the Germans against the British. And this ultimately was the military background that led to the Easter Uprising in 1916. None of this I have any problem with, except that his trial afterwards showed that Casement was a homosexual and pederast, possibly even a pedophile. He was found guilty and hanged for treason. Now, it doesn't necessarily invalidate his report, but it shows that he does realize the biases that are happening. Now, Edmund Morrell, a British journalist, even though really living in France for a long time, and did the same kind of thing. He was an early atrocity porn propagandist, spreading all these, you know, horrid stories, one worse than the next, all which he blamed directly on the king, and he founded the Congo Reform Association, using Casement and many others. And just like today, he was recruiting all of these famous literary figures and celebrities to promote this cause, no different than today. But both of them ideologically were vehemently anti-Belgian, anti-royal, and completely secular. And both of them ultimately turned on their British patrons and sided with Germany. But because of this, he had a deep hatred of King Leopold and the whole nation of Belgium. And he advocated abandoning them to the Germans and didn't think that Britain or France should lift a finger to help the country, and argued against France or Great Britain going to war against Germany at all, which would have been a great thing, but it may have come at Belgium's expense. And Morrell was eventually put in prison for all of it. So the point of all of it is Britain was the Free State's main enemy. They initially recognized in 1884 the Congo Free State as a personal domain of the King of the Belgians, but that didn't last very long. They created the Congo Reform Association, the Relief Association. They even demanded the 14 signatories of the Berlin Conference revoke their point of view. And then many Belgians had resentment over Britain's campaign against Leopold II's activities, especially neutrality against Germany, which drove the British insane. It gets complicated, but the British enmity against Belgium is a cause of the contempt heaped on him, heaped on Leopold, and some of these stories, they got nastier and nastier over time. Stories changed. You know, chopping off arms, killing babies, all this nonsense. And, you know, the issue ultimately is the nature of all of these atrocity stories are identical. It's an industry all to itself. All these evil dictators are described in the exact same way. Everything from, you know, Leopold, Hitler, to North Korea, the Taliban, the Iraqis, whatever. They have a lot in common. The story, it's a template. It's identical, and blanks are just filled in. Whether it be historical versions or contemporary versions, it's very, very, they're identical in almost every case. And some of these marks of this whole genre of, you know, demonizing some king or leader somewhere, no real reason is ever given. There's no rationale for this. It's not in anyone's interest. It's one of the critical marks here. No one even asks why they're doing this. These atrocities are never in the interests of those who are committing them. It's destructive to the group and to the economy. They don't make any sense from that point of view. All alternative understandings are completely rejected. Facts are known absolutely dogmatically. Initially, for contemporary stories, the early press reports are ambiguous, but then over a few weeks maybe, it quickly coalesces into a standardized narrative. You saw that in Syria and in Afghanistan. the claims of how many people were killed are usually laughably high, but they often have a range, a huge wide range from, you know, 3 million to 20 million. So you could fill in whatever you want. Any disagreement leads to irrational and emotional reactions. And you know that there's a lot of phoniness when it's just a morality play, a good guy and a bad guy with no ambiguity. Of course, the bad guy is always associated with Hitler. Rarely is it anyone else. And then they treat this bad guy as a way to piggyback the issue with whatever they want. So Black Lives Matter was using this to justify their burning down cities in, you know, in Europe. The bad guy is always vaguely right-wing in his opinion and motivation, even if he's a communist. Of course, the purpose of this story is to manipulate domestic public opinion, and it's to harm a marginalized group, namely, you know, nationalists, right-wingers of some kind or another. So it's transparently aimed at a contemporary issue. The enemy, their ideological enemy, is said to have agreed with or defend these kind of atrocities. They'll say something like, if the right wing gains power, this sort of thing is going to happen here. So it doesn't matter. I mean, you're always depicted, no matter how much of a communist they might be, or no matter what their ideology, they're always vaguely right wing. Supporters of the bad guy are never consulted. Or at least if they are, they're wildly misquoted. The sources quote one another. The citations all seem to derive from the same few books. In contemporary cases, especially when they're trying to build a case for war, they go to both sides of this artificial spectrum. They go to the left and saying this guy, whoever it is, Saddam Hussein, whatever it is a racist and hates women or something like that, hates Jews for some reason. And they go to the right and they say the bad guy is anti-American or a socialist of some vague sort. They'll have two different arguments for two different groups of people. You'll often see survivors of other crimes trotted out to build their connect their experiences to this. The ideology of the bad guy is always very vague, and it's never presented systematically. My book on the Latin American military juntas shows that these people actually did have a well-developed ideology that no one's ever discussed before, at least not in English. Then there's an assumption of this wide scholarly consensus, which is used to justify marginalizing opponents. There's both the cause and the result of academic censorship on the matter. As I said, the crimes depicted, every one of these cases, they're wildly impractical or way too expensive to make sense. They could just shoot these people, but they don't. They have to be tortured to death, usually with children watching. A common mark of all this is they claim to be able to look into the mind of the perpetrator and see the motivation. Racism or greed or something like that is assumed to be the motivation. And the reason it's a proof and a mark of this whole genre is that it's a work of literature, not a work of history or journalism. They're building a character. They're not reporting any kind of fact. And of course, whoever the bad guy is can never legitimately take power, and there's no way he could possibly be popular. Any show of support for the bad guy is considered to be the result of coercion or bribery or fraud. And the bad guy could do nothing right. The treatments of them, they're absolutely incapable of doing anything right. And even if they can, it's presumed to be based on trying to buy the population off. And usually the aggrieved nation, what we're talking about, his victims, are usually very foreign to Americans, whether it be Yugoslavia or you know, North Korea or Burma. And the crimes that are listed, they're always identical. Mass murder, rape of kids, destroying crops, attacks on innocent people. Children are always mentioned, using very emotional language. And of course, they're identical, and they often get mixed up, using pictures from other stories, and they can't keep them straight. And of course, they always have stories of heroic resistance, and they create this pantheon of heroes, especially in contemporary stories. And they're essentially a pantheon created with very saccharine language. And if, for contemporary cases, like say Xinjiang in Western China, the sources are almost always corporate NGOs or opposition groups in the USA. They never actually go to the government or the embassy or any supporters and see what they have to say. And when you have mass censorship of social media, of academia, which has been going on for a long time, It doesn't matter what anyone said. The bad guy is never consulted. They don't go to his speeches or writings. And he's presumed to be all-powerful. The bad guy is presumed to be all-powerful. The good guys are presumed to be totally innocent. Resistance to the bad guy is, well, heroic. It's futile. Apparently, only the bad guy has any access to weapons. I've mentioned this in the pogrom issue in Ukraine, and certainly in this case, where the FP forces were up against battle-hardened tribal militias. They weren't just, you know, unarmed, innocent people sitting in a hut somewhere. So ultimately, it comes down to all ambiguity is banished. And those are the very basic marks of, you know, all these atrocity stories. All read the same way. It's a template. They have the same structure. They only just change the names. And that's the case in the Leopold story. The official line, and the very fact that there's an official line, shows you that it's really a work of literature. And it does change over time. The Leopold story can't be true. It can't be true mathematically, politically, legally, or militarily. For the story to even be half true, the entire economy would be destroyed. The story is impossible. There weren't 10 million people to kill in the country. There were too few soldiers to carry out any campaign. They were often at war elsewhere. Smallpox was everywhere. The state control over the area was very tenuous. Their victims were well armed. Those writing the initial stories were very biased, as I've mentioned. And the very fact that, you know, disagreeing with this stuff could lead to the destruction of your career, the authors here have probably never even heard serious criticism of their work. Ultimately, the Leopold story justifies the killing, slaughter of whites worldwide, creating this man as worse than Hitler, slaughtering 10 million people for no good reason, and whipping up, and if you see the rhetoric that's used in these websites, it's now become a pop culture thing. It's very shocking. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.